become your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to a new episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Sunday night, April 20th, 2025, as we record this show. It's Easter Sunday, and we at Sox Machine hope that everyone had a wonderful holiday weekend with friends and family. The Chicago White Sox are 5-16 on the season as they won their first road game of 2025, beating Boston 8-4 on Sunday. Matt Theis got the scoring started with a two-run homer in the first inning, and that was all the White Sox scoring until the seventh. Down 4-2, the White Sox stormed back as rookie catcher Edgar Caro delivered the big hit. With runners in scoring position and two outs, Caro singled up the middle to drive in both runs, giving the White Sox a 5-4 lead. Old friend Liam Hendricks, now pitching for Boston, made his first appearance in a game in over 2 years and was greeted rather poorly by his old team. Andrew Vaughn crushed a middle fastball from Hendricks for a two-run homer, his third of the season, to make it 7-4. With the bases loaded in the eighth inning, Theis got hit in the arm by a pitch, a painful RBI, and we'll see if Theis will need further treatment. But the White Sox are on the board with their first road win and will play early Monday morning at 10:10 a.m. Central Time. We'll recap the Boston series and look ahead to Minneapolis in a new Sox Machine podcast that will be recorded on Monday night. So what are we talking about in this episode? Let's check in on the White Sox prospects as Eric Loggenhagen of Fangraphs published his top 40 White Sox prospect list. To check around the White Sox affiliate standings, the Charlotte Knights are currently 7-14. They are 1-9 in their last 10 games. The Birmingham Barons are at 500. They are 7-7. Winston-Salem has a 5-10 record, and Kannapolis is one game below 500. They are 7-8. Some key performances: Tim Elko already has 4 home runs for the Charlotte Knights and is batting .361 with an on-base percentage of .443 and slugging .607 in 17 games for the Knights. Just saying, maybe, just maybe we'll see Tim Elko with the White Sox at some point in 2025, especially if he keeps hitting like this. Birmingham pitcher Tyler Schweitzer has yet to allow an earned run in 10 innings. And Winston-Salem second baseman Gerald Perez is leading the dash with 4 home runs. And for Kannapolis, Braden Montgomery looks like he's ready to join the dash soon, as he already has 3 home runs in 13 games while hitting .327 with a .426 on base percentage and slugging .571. Fangraphs updated their top prospect list for the Chicago White Sox, and they list a total of 40 players with a future value of a 35 grade or better. Noah Schultz, Kyle Teal, Hagen Smith, Edgar Caro, Braden Montgomery, and Grant Taylor all have future value grades of 50 or better. That's great for the White Sox farm system. So is the White Sox farm system improving enough, though, that the future players will be able to lift this franchise back to a winning record in, I don't know, 5 years with the rate that the White Sox are currently playing at? Well, joining me to discuss the Fangraphs rankings is Eric Loggenhagen and some dude named James Fegan. Never heard of him. But Eric, welcome back to the Sox Machine Podcast.
Thank you so much, Josh. Yeah, James, I mean, honestly, you know, he didn't do anything. Like, it's one of those group projects where James puts his name on it, but I was the one working until 1 a.m. to finish it. And then he shows up on the day we have to, you know, deliver the project. And he had a Harold Rosado scouting report. And so I guess he did something, but thanks for having me on.
Yeah. anything to add to that, James?
Look, I just really like, I think his changeup came a long way from last year, and I think that's impressive for a reliever of his age. And I think that observation merits, I don't know, half credit, maybe more.
Well, let's talk about the overall health of the White Sox farm system. Eric, I mentioned all the White Sox players that have a 50 grade or better future value that you placed on Fangraphs. I look at that as a good sign, because it's not that long ago where we were like, raving about three guys having a 50 grade or better for the White Sox. How are you feeling, Eric, about the overall White Sox farm system, especially with all the trades that Chris Getz has made the last couple of seasons?
I think I'm feeling generally positive. I feel mixed positive. There's still some things about the talent pipeline that feel kind of sketchy to me. Like the teams that are the best at this are, turning day two and three college arms into like 40s within a year or two of drafting them. And there's not a lot of that happening here. Like you mentioned, so much of this system are players who they traded for. The result of the rebuild, the end of the last regime, and under Getz, there is not a ton of homegrown talent tracking above the draft expectation, let's say, or the signing expectation here. But they do have, like you said, half a dozen top 100 guys. They have a few more players beyond that who I think you could make like a pretty coherent argument for being on the top 100. And so that stuff is good. I do think that the wave of next good Sox team is like upon us with the pitching prospects who are in Birmingham, the catchers who are, starting to trickle in with Caro debuting, and the fact that the two injured draft picks who fell because of injury and Braden Montgomery and then Grant Taylor are like tracking like healthy, talented, whole entities now. That's very positive too. So I think generally things are going better than they were around like the Cease trade when I was just like, I like Drew Thorpe. But otherwise, this feels kind of underwhelming. And I think like all of the packages that they could have received for Cease at that time were at the very least flawed. But that was one where it was just like, uh-oh, this is maybe not the best start. Trading Gregory Santos as soon as they did, like there wasn't a real reason to do it that early in his years of control. Like stuff like that, I was just like, all right, this is maybe not off to the best start. And then, the Crochet deal does seem to be that big raft of talent that you need to hit on. Like I think of the Royals when they traded Zach Greinke for like Lorenzo Cain and Alcides Escobar and stuff. Like that is the type of deal that feels like it could be. And I think that's a momentum changer for the org.
So, James, after assisting Eric in this exercise, and you've been reviewing other farm teams as well, other teams' farm systems as well around
Yeah,
Major League Baseball.
I've read hot Mason Fluharty takes.
When you look at other teams and you look back at the White Sox farm system, James, are you looking at the White Sox farm system more favorably, or are you nitpicking and seeing where they are still lagging behind?
I mean, I'll be nitpicking them like 10 years after I'm in the grave, I feel like at this point. But on one hand, like it's like a deeper volume of guys to kind of really sink your teeth into, but that feels like almost more of a product of where they're at and what they've been doing the last 2, 3 years than necessarily like they're generating them kind of out of whole cloth, not whole cloth, but like finding more of these kind of surprise upside picks. And one of the big themes here that, they're doing what they can about, but it's going to be a while, is that there's really just no homegrown international talent. And that sticks out even with systems that are shallower, but clearly that's a more of a meaningful percentage of what they're getting on a regular basis. And, I mean, both of them are kind of like good stories. They're neither Brian Ramos nor Javier Moguillon were like, high dollar signings. So like, whatever process led to finding them, their ROI is already pretty good for them as individual signings, but for a class at large, you're just seeing how much things dried up, or just how much the cost is of when you commit the lion's share of the pool to an older Cuban professional, and it doesn't pan out, and you really just have years of essentially not having a class. And if you talk to David Keller, I think he's probably right on the nose about we got to get players from where the most good players come from, and that's the DR, where they've just been very weak for a long time now. But That's going to take a lot of time for reasons of just their progress and also the nature of that market is one, when you sign people at on January or July, January 15th now, it takes a long time to really see that, impact the major league group, but also those deals are obviously done and set up and those networks are established way in advance. So it's just like it'll be a while before we can really bear fruit of it unless they go and, kind of cheat and sign older professional human players again, which is not the process we want.
There's this great book called Future Value that I think you are part of, Eric, if I rattle my brain, my memory cracked. I liked in that book, you and Kylie back in the day, Eric, talking about the whole Dominican Republic and how that market works and the international aspect. You mentioned that the White Sox are struggling to develop day two, day three draftees. But as James mentioned, this is something that's out of sight, out of mind for me because it feels like the White Sox are just rebooting their entire international operations under David Keller. And they want to do it the right way. They're going to build a new academy. But how long does it take to completely reboot and refocus your international efforts?
Yeah, James mentioned it, like just the nature of the market. You could have the will to sign the best player in the 2026 class tomorrow, but that guy's had a verbal agreement with the team for 2 or 3 years. And that's true of 2027, and it's true of 2028 already as we're
Wow.
sitting here. And there are some teams who have 2030s. Done for $5 million. And this is the sort of creep that has occurred in that market when the rules changed. Like, basically, Luis Robert was the last one under the old rules where you're paying a taxed overage if you exceed your soft cap bonus pool for a given, class. Basically, the way teams, would get ahead from then on has been to agree with players younger and younger and younger, and you have teams who are
Now, is
coming to
that
verbal.
legal? This is strictly like under the table, right? Type of deals.
Yes. Yeah, this is not technically allowed. There have been versions of it going on for quite a long time, but it has crept s sooner and sooner in the process. This is the way that teams have decided they can. The only way to get ahead of the other teams from like doing it is commit the player sooner. It's happening, with college athletics as well.
Yes.
There's something about some of the other stuff, the racial dynamics and the economic superpower that is the United States and is the New York Yankees and is the Los Angeles Dodgers against, the impoverished adolescents of the Dominican Republic and their trainers. And the juxtaposition of that makes it more macabre. But yeah, like people's response to the rule changes have been a couple of things. And one is, why not try to commit the player sooner if we trust ourselves to guess who are the best ones? Why shouldn't we be able to do it when they're 12 instead of 14? But the truth is that, like, so much development athletically happens over the course of 6 months when you're that old, let alone 2 years. So, they're mostly doing educated guessing down there. There are some teams who are overcommitting their pool. If you're the Yankees, say, because of what your market size is and what your record is likely to be, in 3 years that you're not going to have an $8 million pool. Even if you wanted to trade for, you can trade for half your original pool amount. So you have some teams, who are overcommitting intentionally and know that over the course of the next couple of years, as these players develop athletically or not, that they can triage them, that there's really no recourse. There was a case a couple of years ago in the Dominican Republic. There were players who the last Angels regime had agreed to sign, and when they were fired, the new group did not honor the previous regime's verbal agreements and commitments. There was a lawsuit filed down there, and we do not know the result of that lawsuit. It's important because it could set precedent for teams continuing to do this or not. Will there be an international draft at some point to try to fight this, quote unquote. I mean, maybe it removes all agency from the players to pick who their future employer is. And that's not great. So there's not an elegant solution here that unless the teams were suddenly to discover some modicum of self-control or good taste, maybe. But JP Ricciardi once told Kylie, keep cashing checks and breaking necks, and those are the people who do well in this business. Those because if you're not the kind of person who wants to sign the 12-year-old, then you can't, because some loon who will is gonna commit that guy. So the White Sox, it's an uphill climb, because even if they wanted to be involved in the top of the market tomorrow, the players who theoretically represent the top of the market are already committed for the next couple of years. They have to do a thing, I think, that like the Brewers do a good job of, and the Guardians do a good job of, and the Diamondbacks do a good job of, which is spread it out. Lots of mid six figure guys. Maybe you have a 1.2 million here or there type of player, but for the most part, diversify your risk, have a bigger, more robust class, invest in your infrastructure down there. A new academy is going to be a big deal. And it has been, it's an investment, not an expense. And hopefully they can make Jerry Reinsdorf or whoever see it that way.
Well, let's go into the specifics for the White Sox farm system. Starting at number one is Noah Schultz, the unicorn, 6'10" now. He's already impressing down in Double A. Jim Callis, when he joined our opening day Eve show at the Remova Theater, Jim and I were chatting like, Eric, he would be the Friday night Vanderbilt starter, Noah Schultz. But instead, he's in Double A right now with the Chicago White Sox farm system and might be joining the White Sox in 2026, if not getting a cup of coffee, maybe an inning or two here and there this September during the 2025 season, depending on his innings limit. But why do you have Noah Schultz as the White Sox number one prospect?
Yeah, the Fangraphs scouting manifesto, like pretty high on the list of Unabomber type, the screed would be bet on the freaks, and a 6'10" guy throwing strikes like this, like let alone, like even before we talk about his stuff, a guy this age throwing strikes like this is pretty nuts. It's really exciting for him to be doing it at this velocity. And for him to be this advanced at, yeah, at 21 and a half, his slider's unreal. It has like pure gyro spin. It's coming in from way, down the first baseline, basically because of his arm angle and because of his size. It just has a ridiculous amount of wipe where it's like starting in the lefty batter's box and finishing on the glove side corner of the plate. And I do think it, has the potential to be one of the better base like sliders in all of baseball. There's stuff that's going on here that is not great and that they haven't solved yet. His fastball is just as vulnerable. As hard as it is, it seeds a lot of contact. The cutter and the changeup, whether him pitching more heavily off of those, which has sort of been the case, last week started Birmingham. A lot of cutters, let's throw strike one with the cutter. I think that those are viable solutions. And I think, when I saw him during the spring, big league game against the Brewers, he and Hagen Smith went back to back in that game. That whole first inning of the two that he threw, he didn't throw a slider until his last pitch of the inning. Like it's clear the developmental objectives are let's find this changeup, let's find this cutter. And I think especially as far as the cutter is concerned, in part because, this guy can really spin it. The ceiling on that pitch is very high. And as loose and whippy as he is, the ceiling on the changeup probably is high over time too. So I think he's going to have the toolkit to deal with the fact that his fastball is just not a great, just doesn't have great shape. It just doesn't have that explosive riding movement that Joe Ryan's fastball has that allows it to miss bats at 92 miles an hour, right? Like, that's just not what we're talking about here. So I think there are going to be situations where he can elevate the heater and it's going to play as a finishing pitch against certain guys. But he's going to have to mix and match early in counts a lot. And they've been pretty proactive about getting him to try to do that. And I think it's going well. So, does he have like peak Strider, DeGrom type ceiling? Probably not, because those guys can throw nothing but fastballs, and 7 innings later they have 12 strikeouts. And but as a front end arm, like maybe not a true ace in the way I would define it, where there are like maybe five of those guys, not quite that, but like the type of guy who can take the ball in game one or two of a playoff series and you're like, this is awesome, like our team is good, yeah, then yes. He's really exciting. They nailed this to this point anyway. And I think he is pretty clearly like tier one on his own in the system.
So, James, it's only been a handful of starts for Schultz as we record this. Are you hearing any feedback from Paul Janish or Brian Bannister, anyone within the White Sox farm system and player development about Schultz's start to 2025?
I would say nothing really out of the ordinary in terms of just like, yeah, they're aware that his sinker like gets contacted with a lot, and so a night like him getting singled to death like in his opening start, I don't think that's like a problem they're not aware of. Bannister's talked about he needs to run up the four seamer a bit more, but also that the cutter is a possible solution and that they would kind of feel their way through both. So it seems like they've tilted cutter, whereas they were really confident in spring about him being able to throw four seamers pretty well, at least more than he has been early going. But I don't think that they're really perturbed or like, oh, something's off by him getting singled. Like, that's kind of the way he will lose games, because it's like people are not going to lift him very often.
Yeah, so his pitching arsenal then, James, in Birmingham, we're looking at two seam slider, obviously. Changeup cutter, is that the four that he's trying to roll with right now, developing wise?
He's probably throwing more cutters than changeups, or will to, because
Okay.
he kind of complained about not feeling like he's another guy who's at the stage of his changeup command where he's like, oh, I gotta set it up perfectly, or I gotta have it as a two strike pitch, or I have to have like set it up with the letters. It's just not something he feels like just pulling out at any given time, the way like, someone like Davis Martin would talk about his kick change at this point.
Got it. So then to compare and contrast, because number three in the White Sox top 40 is Hagen Smith, last year's first round pick. And I liked Hagen Smith out of Arkansas, but you do bring up a really good point, Eric, in your report, especially in spring training and what we saw in his first start with the Birmingham Barons. That first inning gets dicey for Hagen. Like, it seems like he has control issues in the beginning that he's got to overcome. If he can pitch a clean first inning, well, then he's lights out innings second through five. And that I remember that from Arkansas. That was always his tough inning, was the very first inning in his starts when he did struggle. These guys are obviously lefties, and Hagen's not 6'10", but he's got a great slider as well. And he showed a big fastball at least last year college wise. Can you compare and contrast and the similarities and differences between Schultz and Smith?
Yeah, Smith's fastball does have that like riding life and flat angle that gives it that better, more dominant bat missing ability in the meat of the zone. He has margin for error. He doesn't have to have pinpoint command for that fastball to play. The thing that's not going well is the strike throwing. And I think when your fastball plays like this, that sometimes, especially against like college hitters, college baseball is not good. Like, it's just not good baseball. Even in the SEC, the hitters that you're facing at Double A are much better. And I am kind of wondering if he was overassigned, which I would not have told you, 6 months ago. I would have been like, no, that seems properly aggressive to send him to Double A. And so it's hard for me to fault the org, but now that, this is the maiden voyage has left here, it does feel a little aggressive, because he's really struggling to throw strikes. And It's making it so that he's boxed into counts where he has to lean on his slider just to throw strikes at all. His changeup is not developing because he cannot get ahead in situations where he'd be able to use his changeup. And it's sort of hurting his development right now that the double-A hitters aren't as chase prone versus his fastball as the college hitters were. Smith had strike throwing issues as an underclassman at Arkansas, and then they seemed solved during his junior year. And how you handle that as a scout, it's questioned because did he get better or is he likely to regress to the mean? You might have different people in different front offices or different scouting departments telling you different things about that. What is the real Hagan Smith? Is it the guy? Is he improving or is who he's been most of the time, which is kind of wild, who he's likely to be going forward? And that is the sort of area that we're in with him now, is he has backed up, his command has backed up enough at the start of this year that I'm not sure what the answer to that question is. I do think that he would just be paving over high A hitters if he were at, Winston-Salem. I don't know that it's like necessarily the answer is like to demote him and like try to make it so he can go deeper in games or just try to ride this out. Like it's only two starts. Well, it's not really because the spring looks were kind of rough too. But yeah, I think this guy's got a monster slider. His fastball has enough ride and velo that even if he's going to be sitting like 94, 96 early and like maybe averaging 94 across his whole starts, that it's going to play. It doesn't need to be commanded with such, fine East West. It doesn't have to be Jamie Moyer or anything like that. But you don't want him to be Ace Lacy. That's the guy who like popped to mind for me when I was just like, who was also picked this high? Who maybe? Oh yeah, Ace Lacy. Like the window of Ace Lacy throwing strikes was even shorter because it was the 4 weeks before COVID shut down everything. So it wasn't even his entire junior year when he was throwing strikes. It was just for a month against, New Mexico State, like with 1 week of conference play or whatever in there. It's not that dire yet, but it is disappointing that like I saw Christian or I saw Hagan Smith twice this spring in person, and I saw like three changeups because he just couldn't like get out of innings. And just in a big league game, in a big league spring training game, you're not gonna be like, all right, let's work on. I know that there's Joey Gallo standing in there, but like, why don't you just work on your changeup or whatever? No. People are going for it. And now that the lights are on and affiliated ball has begun, that's happening too. I think, obviously, I slid Hagen a little bit compared to where he was on the preseason top 100 just because the strike throwing stuff has been so bad so far. But I don't think it's time to panic or anything. And I think as far as the changeup stuff is concerned, and we'll probably talk about this as we continue to move on. But the org seems able to develop them all of a sudden, like in a, if there's a thing to worry about for later that seems like it's a growing core competency of the org, it is changeup development. And that's the thing that he didn't really need in college because these two pitches were so nasty. The way the path toward his ceiling is a third and fourth pitch eventually. His career's just begun. There's not a rush here. They're not crunched on time for development. It would be nice if he raced to the big leagues very quickly and was just dominant the whole time, but it doesn't seem like that's going to happen, and that's okay. But we are sort of off. The sea is rocky here as things get going.
James, the organization isn't going to go back to its old ways like they did with Carlos Rodon, right? Because that was the idea that last year during the draft, that even on MLB Network on the set, you would hear Harold Reynolds be like, he could pitch out of your bullpen right now. We're not going to see the White Sox be that drastic rushing Hagan Smith, are we?
I think he was on a trajectory where if it went well, they wanted him to do the Jairi Arrate thing last year, of pitching like short like single inning outings out of the bullpen in like September, like at the back end of his like innings allotment. It was probably gonna be a little bit harder for him than Schultz, because I think he's more on like the one, I think they're both kind of in the 110 bucket, but you know, Schultz has thrown a bit more. But I think that's dependent upon, I would say that should be dependent on his success, but they went and threw Jake Eater in the bullpen last year, as wild as he seemed to be at the time as well, which wound up being more of a last hurrah. So I don't, obviously there's no like motivation to actually rush Hagen Smith for a bullpen role or any other role at this point. Like, we're watching what we're watching, and we probably will be for another season or two or three, who knows? So I don't think there's any incentive to, if anything, it could be kind of a mitigating effort of like, well, we're obviously not gonna, we think he's at his innings cap, we're not obviously not gonna start him September, or maybe we're not even gonna start him in Chicago next year, but you know, he could end up with the bullpen as an audition. But there's just one, the those people aren't here anymore who made that decision, and also just the situation, just there's not even like, let's try to make the wild card at 85 wins incentive on the horizon anytime soon here. So I think Hagen's gonna be pretty well insulated from that.
All right, so moving on from the pitching for a little bit, let's talk about position players for the White Sox, because as we record this, the White Sox offense might be winning me a steak dinner bet at the end of the season. The steak dinner bet, Eric, was total runs scored by the White Sox, 555 and a half, and I have the under. And right now, they're not even on pace to score 500 runs this season as we record this, which is pitiful, but the White Sox need more offense. And the top position player that you have is Kyle Teal. Eric, what is Teal's greatest strength as a player?
Oh, that he plays catcher. I think when you can do anything offensively as like a viable to good defensive catcher, which is like what Kyle Teal is tracking as, that you're going to be a valuable big leaguer. The position just does not have great inventory across the entire league. It is a position of attrition because of the beating that these guys take. I think your ability to mix and match and have two good young catchers on your roster to keep them fresh and healthy, it raises the ceiling of the, you know, the position on your team overall across 162 games. I mean, this is an exciting like tandem that they've got here. Teal's going to get to power. He's increasingly strikeout prone. I don't think the, you know, 30 plus percent that we're seeing so far this year is emblematic of where his, you know, true talent lies, but his strikeouts are, they have been on the climb. I do think he's going to end up with like a four hit tool, but he's going to get to power. He's unbelievably twitchy for a catcher. Like, really, his quickness back there is pretty special. His lack of size, like, it's a push and pull for him because there are times when, because he's smaller, there's some stuff back there that he can't do or that he doesn't do well. And then there's some stuff about him, you know, his size that allows him to be quick enough to do things that few other catchers can do. Putting him in position to do those things is going to be important, I think, especially initially. And again, like, it's a slower burn here because of when he was drafted, he doesn't have to be put on the 40 man for a whole another, not even after this season, but after next season. And with Caro playing well, he deserves a long runway at the big league level and see how that goes. And so I don't think they're in any rush here, but like Teal's power, the playable power, I think is just more than Caro's. And Caro is the one with the more stable hit tool, but Teal's defense, the ceiling on it, I just think is a little bit higher. But I have the same grade on those two guys. I think that we came away, both of us, you know, feeling very positive still about those two. And it's just about getting Teal's swing, I think, like, ironed out. His load is so deep. This is a guy with like an arm bar and who his helmet's kicking around and off his head a lot of the time when he's swinging. And I think there's some stuff that they could, you know, maybe do, or just even just be a natural adjustment for that stuff to tone down a little bit so he's not getting beat by elevated velocity quite so much. But I think that both those guys are, you know, build around type, up the middle players who play a premium position and have basically been good both of them their whole lives. There really haven't been till Teal the last couple of weeks. And if you're looking at the arc of his strikeouts over, a longer period of time, maybe it's been trending this way. But both these guys have just hit their whole lives. So there's no reason to think that they're going to stop doing it for an extended period of time.
So James, what are we looking at here? Are we looking at Caro catching Teal DH and they're going to flip back and forth during a week? Or have you heard about the possibility of Teal picking up an outfielder's glove or trying to learn a different position other than catcher so they can at least free up the DH spot?
They're definitely not going to do that this year. Teal is the guy
Okay.
that I think could play the outfield at some point. As Eric pointed out, they've talked about them platooning, and Edgar has been a lot better as a right-handed hitter historically. That's something they've been trying to adjust. I kind of ran the Fuller quote the other day about Edgar's kind of posture issues and his left-handed swing that they're trying to iron out. It's ironic because their age is kind of flip-flop for it, but I think there's kind of a window here, especially with Keel slumping, for Edgar to kind of get regular time. And it's clear that there was a little bit of tension of them just only catching three times a week at max, as developing catchers, that wasn't quite a perfect solution, even if that was really the spot developmentally where they both seemed right at, and they neither one had both had played in AAA, looked all right. Edgar looking a little better offensively, but not really had anything close to even a half season there. It looks like I don't think you bring up Edgar Caro to not give him kind of a runway here. And the way he's hit this season, I think it gives a little bit more idea like this guy can keep his head above water offensively while we, obviously kind of divert a lot of attention to him developmentally on defense. And Teal can kind of develop like a normal top 100 prospect in AAA as a result. So I don't think this is like a full year arrangement, and obviously they need to figure out what they do with Corey Lee when he comes back, because it seems like there's a preference for Tice, but also Corey Lee's kind of he's still like this is he's an athlete or on a level where you see why he got drafted where he got drafted, even if so much skill development as far as his chase and his framing is needs to get better for him to be any kind of full-time role. But I think that they could commit a couple of months to this current setup and feel probably a bit better about how much action they're giving to both the guys they really value over the whole group.
So let's move over to someone that is not having a great start to 2025 and has scared me, Eric, when he was striking out 75% of the time. That's Colson Montgomery. What happened here as he dropped in the White Sox top 40 list for you and he's no longer considered a top 100 prospect on Fangraphs?
Yeah, and this is one of those where it's like, what do you do with this guy? What is his value? The evaluation part of it and the valuation part of it can be so different when a guy is going through it like Colson's been going through it. He has been not good for kind of a while now. And I do think part of the problem is me, is that in 2023, I was part of, the public-facing prospect contingent that just bought in too big too soon based on too small a sample of performance. I think this happens every year. I think the guys who are we are at risk of, doing something similar with going into this year were guys like Zaire Hope and Kevin McGonigal. Adiel Amador was another guy from a couple of years ago where, I was just like, wow, this TrackMan data is crazy. And it's like, yeah, because it's only like half a season's worth of it, and a bunch of it was done during a rehab stint below this player's skill level, which is like true of McGonigal. And I was sitting and thinking of other examples the other day, and they're like, there are a bunch of these. Both from like this year and past years, where I just don't think that the data normalizes as fast as we thought it should. I don't think that the studies that have shown how quickly some of the TrackMan stuff normalizes for big leaguers should apply to minor leaguers, because the quality of the pitching is just not even close. to what these guys would see in the big leagues on a night-to-night basis, or as we're finding out with Colson in AAA on a night-to-night basis. So now, having said that, kind of putting some of the blame on myself for having over-evaluated this guy and maybe setting expectations beyond what they should have been, there's stuff going on here that wasn't going on before. This guy's, miss rate against secondary stuff has totally changed. I think I wrote it in the blurb. If I'm looking at his swing and miss splits from this year, there's way, way, way more him missing secondary stuff. His miss rates against breaking balls and changeups are in the 45 to 50% range, which is really, really terrible. That wasn't the case last year. Last year, he had more issues swinging underneath fastballs with regularity, like a 65% contact rate against fastballs. There are only a couple of big league, like qualified big leaguers from last year, who had a 65% contact rate overall. That's what Colson's contact rate against fastballs was last year. And that has sort of flipped where he was making more like a 70% rate against breaking stuff and an 80% rate against changeups. That's what he was doing last year. And it was just much, much better than this year. So I wonder if there was, and there's nothing mechanically that I could tell going on that was different, but I wonder if they've told him, we want you to be targeting this or that, or like an approach change. Try to, why don't you let the fastballs go by and swing at the breaking stuff that you're just like better at hitting? That could conceivably be going on, and he might be having a really difficult time adjusting to it. But we've really had here 2 seasons now. Not that we're only a couple of weeks into this one, but the AAA season is substantially older than the rest of the minor league season at this point. This guy had a below average line last year too. And have been issues here for a while that just seemed like he was overcoming in 2023, again, in a smaller sample. And when he was in fall league at the end of that year too, it was just like, I don't know, this guy's feel for contact isn't great, but he did just do what he did all year at double A. And so many guys come to fall league and they're just like over it. And it seemed to be that way for Colson. It seemed that way for Kyle Tucker. It seemed that way for Buster Posey. Mike Trout was exhausted. Buster Posey was exhausted. Kyle Tucker couldn't, give a rat's. So, they were terrible in Arizona and they're godlike players. So whenever a guy's terrible in the fall league, I tend to just sort of let it go. Unless it was Jeff McNeil, then I hated his guts. And he was great. But so I've been burned by, taking the lackadaisical fall league look at face value, and I didn't want to do it with Colson, and now I'm wishing that I kind of had, because it was more representative of what some of his issues were than his 2023 stat line turned out to be. This is still, a really physical lefty hitting shortstop who does have real power, and it's just about what can they do to try to hit the reset button here. I don't know how salvageable things are. I do still think like left-handed power plays and you don't want to come off it entirely. And I think, his overall contact rate from last year was still in that 72% area. And we can look at shortstops across the last 15, 20 years who have had good careers and who have had contact rates in that range, like Paul DeJong and guys like this, like get to power, you play an okay shortstop, and even though you're swinging and missing a ton, it turns out okay. Okay to good, and so that's sort of where we're at with Colson. Is if you want to look at it in a more positive light, there's precedent for this. Is it the type of, is he Corey Seager then? No. I feel like that ship has kind of sailed, but like Nolan Gorman, but playing a passable shortstop, that's sort of in there. Miguel Sano, but playing a passable shortstop. That's not crazy. I don't think like Colson has quite that much power, but I'm just like looking at a contact rate, leaderboard here to sort of see like the bottom of the barrel for this guy is like Christopher Morel, Luke Rayleigh. Like these guys are okay. They're role players on a good team. And that's more what we're looking at if we take the snapshot of Coulson from the last year plus, rather than 2023 setting unnecessary expectations, part of which, was my fault. And, then him disappointing off of that, like, no, it was more of us overestimating him than it is this guy, going belly up, truly.
So that's not promising.
Yeah.
The White Sox need a lot of help on offense. James, when you look at the top 40 for the Fangraphs list, and maybe even looking within the top 10, who are you most confident right now, James, that could develop into an impact bat for the White Sox?
Oof. Saw this on the rundown. I really thought it was Eric's question. I guess we have Brady Montgomery, like, has a tool set that, it's accessible. It doesn't need to hit like a 90th percentile outcome to really see it. So I think I would lean that way. I wanted to be kind of on the overrate Brian Ramos train, but Eric has, kind of talked about kind of the offensive limitations there that make it look more like a soft regular than I was initially willing to acknowledge in early spring. Wilco obviously has the ceiling to put him in that position, but that just seems like such a low probability. Like it's such a long climb with his hit tool. And I think kind of the more meaningful outcomes or the more likely outcomes are, even if you like, have a development success where he has some sort of like, actual major league impact, is still like someone who's just so contact limited that kind of defines the profile in a major way. Anyway, like I don't think like the needle you'd have to thread for the Aaron Judge body comps to come true, or it's just like infinitesimally small as it probably was for Judge at some point, but that doesn't mean it's going to happen twice. That's not a great explanation for why lightning is going to strike this one little centimeter location, is that it hit there before. So I think I would lean Brandon Montgomery. I think he's playing below his talent level right now in low A, so I don't want to like get too wrapped up. But as far as like someone who actually has those offensive impact tools and is probably a bit closer to them than really anyone else in the system, because there's not that many guys who just have, meaningfully plus power in the system. Like you could maybe, if you're really want to throw like Caleb Bonnemer into that discussion, but that's, I feel like, an even farther away prospect. To where you couldn't possibly, even if you thought the world of Caleb Bonnemer, like there'd be no meaningful way to project him at this age as like a high probability like than Brandon Montgomery at this point. So I think the guy who demolished SEC pitching is probably the way to go. Seems like the safer way.
How about you, Eric? Do you agree with James? Is Brady Montgomery the best chance of White Sox having or developing an impact bat?
Yeah, I think so. I think, as much as I like Teal and Cuero, and I think those guys are stable, ready, everyday players, Braden's got like variance and ceiling that those two don't have. If everything comes together for him, and I think he's going to swing and miss a good bit. He's just so dangerous all over the zone. Something changed about his swing from a posture standpoint when he left Stanford for A&M. They made real changes to his swing that made him dangerous at the top of the zone in a way that he wasn't before. And then, switch hitters can always develop contact stuff later. Like you're just working with two swings in your teens and early 20s, and in Montgomery's case, you were pitching two. There's chance for late growth in that area. And so I think that he's your best shot. The walkout stuff is tough. Like, there really aren't any hitters who swing and miss as much as he has already who succeed at all. The one who has is Joey Gallo. Like, Joey Gallo's strikeout rates in the minors were always what they were. They were in this area initially, like Wolcows. He did hit better for me towards the end of spring. And he is, yeah, like he is a physicality that is just there are a few people in baseball who have this happening. But yeah, sub 60% contact rate guys, when you're an A ball, they don't end up doing anything usually. Like almost always, usually, like 99 out of 100 times. And even is it's not even a sufficient way of describing it. So he is low probability, extreme variance. If I'm like throwing a dart deeper in the system, Samuel Zavala, I've never really, well, it's not true that I've never been a big fan of his. There was a point when he was initially debuting with San Diego where I was in. He was like towards the back of the 100 list. And then pretty quickly, I moved out because of the stuff that he was struggling with, elevated velocity, swing really needed so much work. But yeah, it's a problem because part of what they didn't do during some of the early part of the rebuild was target hitters, really. This is the sort of the situation we were left with. So yeah, Bonnemer, Cale Bonnemer, another one where I'm just on the lower end of the reasonable takes on Bonnemer. I had him more as like an 800K guy, somewhere in that 800K, 1.2 million, type of high school player last year. They gave him three. So, it's tough. I think there's a chance that Mydroff like totally blows us away and is like Dustin Pedroia or something like that, I guess. I would really be shocked if I think he's a good player that you can win with, but I don't think he's a player you're going to win because of. And that's, that's the type of ceiling that's someone like Brayden Montgomery, like the overtly athletic guys just tend to be the ones who do that. Like when you're built like Fernando Tatis or whatever, like it just tends to be those guys. And instead the system has like the William Bergoyas of the world mostly, who are good little players, but not that level of impact player.
So then trying to find some optimism here. Shane Smith has been starting the year really well, Eric, for the White Sox. Rule 5 pick from the Milwaukee Brewers. Did the White Sox find a Rule 5 steal here with Shane Smith?
Yeah, I think, the Brewers are really good at developing players. They had this guy, and the White Sox made him better than they could, like right away. So I think that's great. Is he going to be, touching 100 every start like he was at the beginning of spring training? It seems like not. His velocity has been declining, to normalizing basically to what it was last year. But he's something. That changeup is a real pitch that just wasn't there before. This is a guy who they drafted and developed as like fastball breaking ball reliever. And I thought, they did a pretty good job, Milwaukee did. And this he was a real middle relief prospect before the Rule 5 selection. But I think they picked the right guy. They made relevant changes right away. And his best pitch is the pitch that they gave him. So yeah, I think the whole kick change thing, and Bannister was talking about it at Saber Seminar last summer. I don't love to go public with what people are saying at Saber Seminar or the Sloan Conference or whatever, because it's just like something sort of a violation to do that kind of thing. And I wondered who else from this org we might see just like you get a kick change and you get a kick change and you get a kick change. And
Well,
they
it's
plucked
Davis
a
Martin, right? James, it's
right.
Davis Martin and Shane Smith.
Smith says it's like he calls it a seam shift changeup for what it's worth. Grant Taylor is a chain kick change. Jake Bakkenstad, I can't say his, don't know his name, but the guy with the long name starts with a B. He's got a kick.
Bockenstedt.
Bakkenstad.
3,000 RPM curveball. He could have been on the extra section of the list too. But those are exactly the guys that they should be doing it with. Like I just did the Orioles list, and they take these guys who have good natural breaking ball and give them this style of changeup. They're just like, you have a good whatever, it doesn't matter what it is. Day two and day three college arms who have a good natural breaking ball of some kind. They give them a second one, And they give them this changeup and they do it right away. And it's how you turn a guy who no one cared about a year ago because he was an eighth round pick who got, 200K. They're a dime a dozen. And now they're, oh, and he had a velo spike too. Well, now you're a 40 plus. And I thought that, I think it's pretty encouraging and it's something to look for going forward. Like, the integration of draft and dev together is the only way that the best orgs separate themselves from teams like, who aren't doing a good job at this. And I think if you, especially if they took Smith knowing this is what they were going to do, that's a great sign.
So then finally, outside of the top 10 White Sox prospects, Eric, which White Sox prospects are most intriguing to you from rank 11 through 40?
I think Christian Opor, I think that he, like, you have him stacked with Wikelman Gonzalez because they're sort of similar. Where you could, if you told me that these guys had three plus pitches at peak, I'd believe you. And if you told me that they could never command the baseball well enough to be anything at all, I'd also believe you. With Opor, it's small school background, it's. He's barely 21. I don't even think he's 21 yet. It's like low release lefty. He was in the mid 90s yesterday in his last start before we published a list. And yeah, like monster lateral slider. I think he's really interesting. And the only reason he's 24th and not like up there with Tanner McDougal, basically, or somewhere in that 40 plus group, at least with Batista and Tyler Schweitzer, who also looks good, piggybacking with Grant Taylor, like sit 95 last Saturday, I guess, when all, everyone had double headers and my t the TVs in the house were just all on with White Sox games, picture in picture White Sox games. It was just like, giving myself ADHD with White Sox farm system write up. But the only reason he's not up there, stuff definitely belongs in that group, is because the command is so unpolished. And just the way I'm trying to ballpark his value, we've got to leave room for the bottom end of his outcomes too. And the bottom end is this guy has three control and is like an up down type guy. So he's the one where his development I think is very important because if you told me, if he ends up with like 45 grade command and his stuff just sort of stays the same as it is now across 100 innings or so, well, then in 2 years he'll be a top 100 prospect because lefties who throw this hard with breaking balls this good, there really aren't very many of them. But it's just about like how the command piece of it trends.
All right. How about you, James? Outside of the White Sox top 10 from number 11 through 40, who intrigues you the most?
Kind of because like I've spent so much time covering like major leaguers, something that's like as we've started this process, like Eric started me out on a lot of like upper level guys because that's what I'm closer to seeing. I think I told you about him sending me to watch Dax Whitney and me being like, oh, he doesn't have his like a third pitch and stuff like that about a college freshman.
And I had to scold you. Yeah, he's a freshman. That's his first start ever, James.
So I wound up like watching a lot of relievers,
Okay.
and as a result, like I think traditionally it's been obviously you call somebody who's starting currently starting in the minors a reliever, it's like an insult. You're saying like this project is not going to work. But for me, it's like a lot of like starters who are like, or not a lot, but like a fair amount of starters who are like, all right, this is like meh. Like you see them kind of like spin their wheels a lot night in, night out. Whereas I'm looking as like, this is going to be so much fun when he's a reliever, man. Like, this is going to be great. Like, Tanner McDougal's still working his ass off to start. But, like, I just like watching the raw stuff is like, this is going to be so cool. Like, yeah, he can't command his fastball, but who cares when he's throwing it 30% of the time in 3 years and just spamming off speed at everybody? Like, this is a hammer he's got. Like, that. So, Seth Keener, like, it's not like a fastball that's like stands out in any way. But, like, he came in already with a plus slider, so seeing kind of the progress of the changeup, where he had a 40% miss rate on it. Obviously, he pitched mostly against low A, and as a wake arm, like he was kind of playing with his food a little bit, but that seemed to be like that's something that could be a pretty good reliever, and plays around a Baltimore heater. And I see Harold Rosado was like a pure reliever already, but for someone who like has only pitched an A ball and is pretty young, and like there wasn't a lot of fuss about from the Paul DeYoung trade when he came over, or like not even the org like really telling us like, hey, pay attention to this guy. It just seems like for the level he's at, given he's an A ball reliever, like now he's in double A, but it's just very low variance. I feel like he kind of does what he does and has performed like really steadily throughout and thrown strikes at an acceptable level, like even like it's obviously reliever command. And I don't think he's gonna, I think his fastball is gonna play down, and he's just gonna like throw these kind of tumbling changeup and curveball after it and be really nasty off of that more than anything. But like he just like this is pretty cool. Like I enjoy watching this guy. So yeah, it's not. You need stars in your prospect system. Some outlets only write about stars. Like that's kind of what people look to prospects out. But like there are a lot of, I think, for as much as like this current bullpen like lacks in any firepower, and maybe that this future good White Sox rotation maybe isn't as filled out as you'd want it to be. I think there's a lot of these kind of mid-tier guys could be cool relievers, especially if like they're kind of adding, they're only just kind of pure slider guys, and now they're able to add changeups that bodes well for them to at least be able to compose that cheaply and more effectively than we've obviously seen them doing the last few years.
Well, the White Sox have lots of spots on their upcoming roster, so they're going to need help. Bullpen, offense, some starting pitching. But this was a very worthwhile endeavor, Eric and James, to talk about the Fangraphs top 40 White Sox prospects. You can read their excellent work on fangraphs.com as Eric and James will continue updating reports on all 30 farm systems in Major League Baseball. Soon enough, the Major League Baseball draft will be here, and I look forward to reading Eric's thoughts about the upcoming class of draft prospects. Eric Loggenhagen, thank you again so much for coming back on the Sox Machine podcast, man.
Josh, anytime. Yeah, I look forward to talking to you, hopefully around draft time and about Eli Willits. I'm just looking at whatever prospects are in the Midwest
I just
that
updated
they
my
could
top
compete.
50, and I already feel like in a month I'm gonna have to update it again. We're not
Yeah.
progressing with some guys. We're regressing.
Yes, it is that it is a class of attrition, it turns out. That yeah,
Yes.
Jace LaViolette was on the banquet circuit. And now looks like he does and is, yeah. But thanks so much for having me on. What do you think? Which one should James and I co-parent next? Should we do Milwaukee or Cleveland together next?
Give James Milwaukee. I'm intrigued because these are guys that the White Sox might be targeting in the
Yeah.
offseason. Do some homework for the winter meetings when the White Sox make another Rule 5 pick again. But again, you could
Deal.
also read James's excellent work and hear him often on the Sox Machine podcast. But again, Eric and James, thank you guys so much for joining the show to talk about the White Sox prospects. That will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the Sox Machine podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts such as Spotify and Apple Music. You could also listen and watch the show on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on all the social media platforms. We are at Sox Machine. Follow us on Blue Sky at SoxMachine.com. You can follow James on social media at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh or on Blue Sky at Josh.SoxMachine.com. If you want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, including the Major League Baseball draft, sign up to become a Sox Machine subscriber at SoxMachine.com. Monthly plans start at $5, and that gets you ad-free version of both the podcast and the website, unlocks all of our articles and also the comments section as well. We have additional tiers of support if you like more benefits with your subscription to Sox Machine. Your support goes a long, long way. So again, thank you to all those that continue to support Sox Machine, and if you are brand new, you can sign up at SoxMachine.com. The Sox Machine podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire podcast network. I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.